This is Anne DeVore, May 17, 1991, Yeats, Body of Fate.
I went into the hazelwood because a fire was in my head, and cut and peeled a hazel wand and hooked a berry to a thread. And when white moths were on the wing and moth-like stars were fluttering out, I dropped the berry in a stream and caught a little silver trout. When I had laid it on the floor, I went to blow the fire aflame, but something rustled on the floor and someone called me by my name. It had become a glimmering girl with apple blossom in her hair who called me by my name and ran and faded through the brightening air. Though I am old from wandering through hollow lands and hilly lands, I will find out where she has gone and kiss her lips and take her hands and walk among long dappled grass and pluck till time and times are done the silver apples of the moon, the golden apples of the sun.
Thank you, Margaret. It's fortuitous that she was here because I was going to try to do that for you, but you see, I'm a lecturer, not a storyteller. And the subject of the lecture, The Body of Fate, is really about the dance of the Silver King and the Golden Queen. And this poem that he wrote very early in his life pictures this dance and the importance of the relationship between the masculine and the feminine and the sun and the moon. What we'll do is wander through this lecture, and then I'll ask Margaret to read it to you one more time so that at the end of the lecture you will intuitively know what this poem is about. You have the first slide. William Butler Yeats was an Irish poet born in 1865. And this is a very interesting person in the sense of his life's work. He was prolific. He was a poet as well as an essayist. And he was also a politician and a senator. He served in the Irish Senate, and he also served as the director of the Abbey Theatre. He was a playwright. He also was a Nobel laureate. This is a very grounded man who knew about life. He had a wife and children. He was loved by many people, and he served his country well. And so then there is a part of his life that I find puzzles and brings one to wonder, as W.H. Auden said, what a man of his intelligence was doing dabbling in those strange occult things. Yeats's greatest work, in his own opinion, and this is not the opinion, I believe, of most people in lit criticism, but Yeats's own opinion of his work was that A Vision was his masterpiece. And it was his attempt to tell us about the development of the soul. And the development of the soul was to become not only his life's passion, but he did some rather strange procedures in order to get direct access to what we would call soul knowledge. In his youth, and around the age of 20, he left the university, and he began a system of self-study, which we would find interesting if we only looked at the book list. But in addition to the book list, there were certain practices which are described in treatises by modern magicians, particularly those of the Golden Dawn, which describe many of the things that Yeats and his friends were studying and practicing. He married a woman who was 26 years younger, and he was 52 at the time, and she was 26 at the time. Next slide. This young woman, Georgiana Lee Hyde, was a member of the Golden Dawn, and she was very intuitive. One could say a medium type and a medium. And 6 days after their wedding, she began what he called the Great Experiment. And for 4 years, next slide, these two people sat 2 to 3 hours a day on every day that they were either alone or neither of them were ill or they were not on the road traveling. And they attempted to communicate with the teachers, as Yeats called them. The teachers were disincarnate, and they communicated through the medium, who first began with a series of attempts at automatic writing. And after about 18 months of the automatic writing, they switched to what Yeats called the dream sleeps. And in trance state, Yeats began a long discussion, many questions that he would prepare, and he would gather careful notes, and at the end of each session, they would catalog the notes. And at the end of 4 years' time, which is right about the time that this trip, 1921, was taken to the United States, they had compiled 4,000 pages of dream sleep notes and automatic writing. The subject matter was to become his greatest work, which is A Vision. A Vision was not published until 1925. It took him from 1921 to 1925 to edit and compile the notes, and it was revised again in about 1937, about a year and a half before he died in 1939. The subject of A Vision is a system of personality development, if we look at it strictly on an incarnate level, which is called the phases of the moon. If you read between the lines, what Yeats really is trying to talk about are 28 phases of soul development, and that's the subject that we will discuss this evening. You want to turn the slide. This is Thor Ballalee, and this is in County Galway. This is the summer home of William Butler Yeats and his wife. He built the tower for her, but in fact, this was the tower that was to become the focus of his greatest symbol. This is the symbol in the tarot deck for insight, for sudden insight, which changes your philosophy in one stroke. The mechanisms of Yeats' system, which you could symbolize by this tower, are also synonymous with what Yeats calls the body of fate. The body of fate is to be encountered and to shape your life. It is an interaction between you and event. The body of fate is in part what we could call synchronicity, but is in fact, you could say, the soul and its mechanisms operating through you to receive the lessons that it needs for this lifetime. And the tower became his greatest symbol. This is the inside of the tower. It's the spiral staircase, the gyre. This is the winding, spiring, gyring treadmill of a stair, which we all tread, which is the shape of life itself. And the Irish government has turned this into a museum, and they have attempted to tone down the colors that Yeats had painted it to do his work. When Yeats worked in this tower, he would go to the very top of it and he would do his meditation. And to get into the state that he needed to be in, he would climb the stair thinking about the color on the wall, which was a very bright turquoise blue. And the Irish government has painted it a rather subdued color to cover it up, but you can still see the blue through it. The bedroom that he slept in had a black ceiling, and then the rays of the sun were painted gold, and they came right to a point over his head to receive dreams. And this was, all of this was really important to him in terms of the symbols that he worked with. I think that you would have to read a lot about the Magicians of the Golden Dawn to understand why he did such preparation. It had purpose to him. The next slide. The stare comes from Blake's work. When Yeats was a young man, one of his first pieces of work was with Yeats. Well, actually, you could say it was with all of the poetry of Blake. And with a man named Ellis, they attempted to systematize all of the content. And when he was really, I suppose, 22, 23, he began working with Jacob's Ladder and The Spiral. And the evidence of... turn to the next one. It's too bad you can't see this one a little clearer, but this is... These are the charts that These are the charts that Yeats constructed to explain all of Blake's work. And in the top chart, you see that he has 27 heavens and the mundane shells from the works of William Blake. And in the bottom chart, you see the descent and ascent of reason, which is the equivalent of the soul body in Yeats's work. So this was published in 1893. Yeats was about 26 years old when this work was completed. This is an example of what we are going to discover the body of fate to be, which is your life's work is often contained in the kinds of things that you're drawn to very early in life, and the things that you study, the things that you cannot lay aside. And in a way, what Yeats would say is that, this piece of work, these symbols, were meant for him. You cannot escape this if you tried. What Yeats is going to develop is a system of 28 phases of the sun and the moon, and he is going to have a spiral kind of action to describe the will, the mask, the creative mind, and the body of fate as it works in our life. This is a dynamic system. It is not a system of personality. If you read a vision, you will note that each of the phases has a personality description, but it was not meant to be a static kind of thing. Okay. You want to turn that back on? What Yeats basically said at the end of his life was, did the book, A Vision, come from other mouths, the disincarnates, or was the book in fact the product of my own mind and scholarship? And this was a question that we could well ask. How much of the book came from the channeling and the questioning that he and Georgie did, and how much of the book came from the very careful body of scholarship that Yeats was to complete by the age of 50 that really consumed the better part of his life until he met his wife. From the age of 20 to 50, he basically was involved 2 to 3 hours a day in some kind of library research that covered the field from Plato to Plotinus to the Renaissance to Blake to Dante, Swedenborg, Berkeley. He studied the Upanishads. He studied Eastern philosophy. He knew a lot about Irish history, He was immersed in Celtic thought. This was a man who really never stopped learning. And so when he began his researches as the experiment at age 52, what he brought to the work were tremendous amount of unsolved problems having to do with Platonic thought, and thousands of questions which his mind was able to systematize and painstakingly ask day after day after day. And so one would ask, was he speaking to himself, or was he speaking to his teachers, as he called them? And, you know, that remains a question in anyone's life who does intuitive work. Can you have a dream that is not based upon some experience of yours, whether you remember it, in fact, or not? To understand the working of the tower and the gyre, or the wheel, Yeats worked from the point of view of this life. And he called this life one instance in the turn of the wheel. Fate is one turn of the spindle of necessity. The spindle of necessity is easy to describe in this life, if you know anything at all about Pythagorean number system and Pythagorean astrology. What Pythagoras and Plato were teaching is that each of us makes a choice to incarnate. This is a soul's decision. You have a lesson to learn or a body of work to do. You want to come out of great love for the planet, but in any case, you're attracted into the body. And the personality, the incarnating ego, is determined by the moment of time that your soul descends through the spheres. Now, the sphere, to Plato or to Pythagoras, was the orbit of the planet of this solar system. Now, Pythagoras knew that we are a solar-centric planet. However, if you want to describe incarnation, you have to work from a geocentric kind of theory. And so the numbers and the rhythms and the harmonies of the soul can only be understood if you stand on the planet, on the earth, and view above you, if you will, the shells, the spheres, that would be made if each of the planets were a solid sphere around the earth. And so the sun and the moon and the earth are in a dance that is balanced and colored by the positions of all the other planets. So when the spindle turns and the soul descends, you make note of the position of all the planets and the sun and the moon at the moment of birth. We call that an astrology chart. Plato called it the spindle of necessity. And Yeats calls it the body of fate. At that instant, and only that instant, a soul incarnates into a particular body, and there is no other body like you, including an identical twin, which cannot be born at exactly the same moment. There is a separation, ever so small, even if it's 1 minute, which will change something in that spindle of necessity. And one of Yeats's great experiences in life was a dream that he had when he was about 41 years old. And he awoke in the dream, it was a lucid dream, to find a great angel sitting by the bed. And this great angel looked at him and said, "You know, not doing your work. You were meant to be a poet, and you're wasting your time on this Irish rebellion. And you're wasting your time with the rabble in the streets and all these silly speeches. And if you want to be doing your work, then you must begin the poetry. And you are William Butler Yeats. And if you do not do the poetry, God is deprived of that essence of William Butler Yeats, and he won't know that part of himself. And this explained to Yeats exactly what he was, which is an emanation from God. And what this is contained in is the Platonic doctrine, or the Platinian doctrine of the emanation of the soul from the One. Now, the One, in order to understand himself, itself, herself, had to split into two. And in Plato's beautiful dialogue of about love, he talks about the two originally being of one body, and they are cut in half. One has female genitals, the other has male genitals, and they spend the rest of their lives madly rushing about, embracing other people of opposite gender, looking for the proper half. And this would be the union that would put the soul back into harmony. And if you imagine all of these sparks out there running around looking for each other, that union of opposites is the sun and the moon that Yeats is going to try to explain, that Jung would call the alchemy of the opposites, the coming together of the masculine and the feminine. But in Yeats's term was really the dance of the sun and the moon. And if you can reconcile the dance of the sun and the moon and make that a unified being, the subjective and the objective, then you understand what God is trying to do in bringing all of us home. And this is an emanation theory. So the way this works is that in order to know himself, God splits into many beings. They all descend into matter. They gain experience and then remember where they came from, and then they all want to go home. And that is the ascent part. In this way, when you go back into the light, you're taking the consciousness that you gained in this lifetime back into the One. And you then contribute to the ever-growing, ever-knowing, ever-increasing consciousness of the One. And so this is Plato's explanation and Yeats's explanation of the ever-expanding and very conscious universe that we live in, that is ever-creating and always seeking more knowledge, more consciousness. Okay, so the wheel as it turns is what we're interested in. Let me see if I can find myself here. Okay, go to the next one. In Yeats's vision, he's going to work with two spirals. They are going to interact. There is going to be a subjective side and an objective side, and we are going to deal in time and in space, because after all, we are here in a body. Go on to the next. And the way that this reacts is the primary phase is the sun. The antithetical stage is the moon. The primary stage is the objective. The antithetical stage is the subjective. The primary stage is the beginning of ego development. The antithetical stage is the height of ego development. The moon, the full moon, is the symbol. And they're constantly moving in and coming apart and moving in and coming apart. And this is the dancing of the spires. You can go ahead. If you look on the two diagrams that were in the book of 1925, you also get a perspective of the what he calls the alpha and the omega, the you get a perspective of this being the solar world, this being what Aristotle and Plotinus would call the lunar and sublunar world, where we live in a body. And you get a sense of the body of fate, the will, which is what drives the body of fate, the mind, which is the creative mind, and the destiny will, mind and fate, all kind of crashing in together. Go on with this. And the action of all of this, this is the vision from 1925, then it's revised to 1937. With phase one and move around, you can see that he's made a moon chart, which is very much just moving from the new moon to the full moon, and then the waning moon goes back into the darkness again. If you look at the quarters, you can see that he has the four quarters. You can also see that he's divided this in a way that each quarter has two parts. And he has decided to incorporate astrological symbols, but what he learned as he tried to work with this system is that it did not work out in terms of what we know as Earth astrology, and he gave that up. He also tried to reconcile this with Blake's Four Worlds, and that didn't particularly work out. And so what he decided to describe is a system that we could say is ego development, but what he will say to you is that in order to study the soul, we have to study the instance of incarnation, which is this life. We can't talk very much about the soul because we're not there. And he fully believed that we drank from, it's a river that runs through heaven that is the river of forgetfulness. And so you really don't remember too much about who you are in a continuous life. You're only aware of this particular life. And so there isn't any point in trying to talk about the soul level when we are incarnate. He's also going to deal with time. For Blake, time was a fall from eternal and timeless experience. And Blake is very much like Plotinus. He was not happy to be incarnate and was not very interested in the fall from the eternal experience. Yeats, however, was very interested in soul development, and so time and space became very important to him. And he is very quick to tell you that this is not a system of what we would call ascendance or transcendence from the body. He was not interested in leaving the body, and he was not interested in getting off the wheel of incarnation too quickly. He was very interested in life and all of its experiences. His greatest character in all of his books was Red Hanrahan, who was the fool who was driven through life and meandered on all of its paths. He was very interested in every little story that all of his friends told. He was a great gossip, and he was not in a hurry. So this is a man who had plenty of time to think about 28 phases of personality development, soul development, and look forward to all of them. Reincarnation is part of this theory because one could say that in this lifetime you are going to go through at least 28 different phases, and if you track it and divide all of the different phases that he describes in the four ages of man. You could say, yes, I've had 28 phases to my life. You could also say that he believes that the soul will go through 28 phases of 28 steps. So he wasn't in a hurry to finish you up. And he believed that once you had completed the 28 phases, you probably would repeat them again, too, because some of them were so important, you wouldn't want to miss them. Life after life after life. But in this lifetime, you'll have 28 also. Yes. Let's see. Other interesting comments. He actually wrote a poem about incarnation, and he once asked, he said, I asked if I should pray, but the Brahmin said, pray for nothing. Say every night in bed, I have been a king, I have been a slave, nor is there anything, fool, rascal, knave, that I have not been. And this would be the summation of his attitude about whether or not you should practice yoga and get out of the body any too soon. He would say, no, I have been a king, I have been a slave. There are four ages of man, and if we look at the first quarter, the light at the top to the first quarter, and then the second quarter and the third and the fourth, he calls these the four ages of man. He with body waged a fight, but body won, it walks upright. Then he struggled with the heart, innocence and peace depart. Then he struggled with the mind, his proud heart he left behind. Now his wars on God begin. At stroke of midnight, God shall win. And what that translates into is what he calls, in the first instance, the will. He with body waged a fight, but body won and walks upright. This is the math. Then he struggled with the heart, innocence and peace depart. This is the creative mind. Then he struggled with the mind. His proud heart he left behind. And this is for the body of fate. Now his wars on God begin. At stroke of midnight, God shall win. Another way of putting it is that during the first half of life, you work on developing consciousness of individuality. And the will is about instinct and drive. And the math is about becoming what Campbell and would call the heroic person, the one who has a mission and does it well. After you have reached your full subjectivity, one could say fully egocentric and full of self, then something happens, and he calls it the changing of the tinctures. And if you imagine those gyres that are moving toward one another, well, they have to reverse. And then they reverse, and you begin shedding everything that you gained before. And at the creative mind part, you realize very much what Jung would say, which is consciousness is now what counts. And you have to redo your life in some way so that you become conscious of all the choices that you made or all the choices you didn't make. And in fact, your most creative time would be after the crisis of midlife.
Incorporating the shadow of life that hadn't been lived up to that point.
Well, or doing something with it, Yeats would say. Now that you've acquired it, what are you going to do with it in a creative way? Right. So it's like, now is the time for the poetry, and now is the time for the novel, and now is the time for contributing, in Plato's terms, to the society. in a creative way, because this is about making something new. But something happens at the last quarter, and you realize in Plato and Plotinus' terms your origin. And the last part is for the spirit. And it's when you begin to shuck it all. You really don't need all of that ego and all of that power, and you aren't much interested in it anymore. And what you really are trying to do is regain this objective status. And God wins at the stroke of 12, which is at the moment of death. I don't have a lot of room up here, but you can imagine it this way. Have any of you ever made a lens for a telescope, and you've got a convex and a concave, and you've got a reflector and a light? And this is another way of looking at the parts of this personality soul system. And the sun, the light, is God's mind. And it is the objective phase. It is this light from which you come when you incarnate. The mirror is man's life. And it is the subjective world. It is also voluntary and acquired. In this system, no one comes here for punishment. This is not a karmic system based on retribution. This is a karmic system based on desire. And it is a karmic system, if we want to use that word, based on necessity. Because God emanated of necessity, it is important to get back to the light, to be part of the One. And in order to do that, you have to remember where you came from and turn around and go with those gyres back to the light. In this life, we have a will, a mask, a creative mind, and a body of fate. The will and the creative mind are time and space, and they unite object and judgment. The faculties of a human life are all contained in the mask. Jung would call it an archetype. An archetype is a pattern for human life. The hero, the senator, the doctor. You could say that sounds like a persona, and that's exactly what Yeats calls it, is the mask. The mask that we present to the world is the unifying factor in most of our lives. But in fact, if you need to say what is the dynamic in Yeats's system, it is the body of fate, which is going to, in the second half of life, do everything it can to destroy the mask. It is not real. The mask is not who you are. And the body of fate will conspire to do everything it can to break this notion of identity totally away. When we begin to realize that we are not the mask, we become aware of the higher faculties or principles. And so corresponding to the will on the soul level is what Yeats calls the husk. It's the part of our soul that is responsible for incarnating, and it's a husk. You begin to realize you're walking around in a robot that is getting old, and it's creaking, and it hurts, and it's not very attractive anymore, and you want to get rid of it like a husk. I mean, that Plotinus reached a point where he was embarrassed to be in a body. Yeats never reached that part. He liked being an outrageous, raging old man. He loved it. The mask is, in Yeats's term, the passionate body. When we are young and we have identified with our life's work, we love it. We are passionate about it. We tell everyone about it. We are becoming it. That's the feeling world, in a way. And on the soul level, that is also true. There is a passionate side of the soul world. And in one of his plays called The Unicorn from the Stars, he basically writes about this, and he says, you know, heaven is not all singing and quiet. The lover still loves, but with a greater passion. The rider still rides, but with greater fury. And the wars, they rage on. And he saw heaven very much as a dynamic place where life is even more fuller, more, what would we say, intense than earthly life. Flamboyant, yes. The angels all ride unicorns, and they trample the earth. The creative mind, the part that wants to make something new in this life, corresponds to the whole spirit that has incarnated. And what a doctrine of incarnation presumes is a continuous life for the spirit. And so each episode of life that we know as incarnation is to add to the spirit body, to make it more rich, to make it more delineated, more intense, you could say, but it's always looking to the future, wanting more consciousness. The body of fate, the thing that forces us to change in this life, corresponds in Yeats's terms to the celestial body. And this is where the soul body begins to return to what Jung would call the anima mundi, the part of our world that is larger than each of us. And it's as though you suddenly realize you are part of something very large. You are not alone. You are not unique. You are indeed part of a greater light. And that is the celestial body. The principles and the faculties are all united in the celestial body. That is a unified body. The spirit and the celestial body prevail between lives, and the faculties and the will in particular and the mask prevail in this life. So you get this sense of the figure ground reversal, but you also get a sense that they reflect each other, and if you understood yourself at your core, how you live your life and how your soul is in fact are very much the same. And, you know, Yeats made a lot of comments in his book about very beautiful people and very beautiful souls. He also talked about the kinds of work that a particular kind of soul would produce. Plato tried to do that in the Republic. I mean, if you think about the Republic as Plato produced a utopian writing, we could say that. But really what he was describing was the city of God and the kinds of souls that each of the royal metals, gold and silver and bronze, if your soul comes from one of these metals, the kind of work you would produce and what your responsibilities are. And in a way, Yeats believed that all of us have these kinds of soul essences, and life after life after life, we would know each other, regardless of the costume we're wearing in this particular incarnation. So you can't escape it, you can only develop it. The sun and the moon are the great symbols that represent the figures of the objective object and the mirror. And what is being reflected in our world, if we can really concentrate on the essence of our own lives, is the light itself. In Plato's work, his last dialogues, particularly the Timaeus, he focused on God's nature as reflected in the light of the universe, or the world soul, or the anima mundi. Plotinus focused on God's light as reflected in man's light, or the spark, the monad, the monadic core of our existence. And it was really to Plotinus's work on the spark that Yeats gravitated. In Plato's time, the sophistic heresy was to equate the light with the spark. And in Plato's time, it was punishable by death to make a sophistic error, which is to say, I am a god. And in Yeats's work, he is very careful not to violate this rule. We are not becoming gods. We are returning to the one, to God. We are a part of God, but we are not God. We have a light, but we are not the light. And this was very important in Yeats's work. And you can figure out, if those of you who know astrology, what your phase is by looking at the distance from the sun to the moon. So if you have, let's see if I can think of something here without getting in trouble in public on astrology. If your sun is in Sagittarius and your moon is in Capricorn, you would have a phase of the moon that is within 30 degrees. If you have a chart, you're born into what they call the beginning phases of emanation. You're building a new phase of the will. If this is Sagittarius and you have to find Libra, which would be somewhere around here, you're born into a later phase of the moon, and all of your life you're going to be more or less kicked around by the body of fate. And these phases are very difficult phases because they are the phases that require total objectivity. And he also named them strange things, like the hunchback and the fool, the sage. If you're born in the phase of the hunchback, you often even have a physical deformity. And he listed, you know, Balzac and some interesting people like that. His best friend, John Synge, was a 23. And John Synge, as you may know, wrote very interesting plays about the Irish race. These plays so inflamed the people that lived in the small towns he wrote about that they had riots, and they didn't want to look in the mirror. They did not want to look in the mirror. And Yeats's phase was 17, and he believed that one at 17, 18, those phases of the moon, had not only the right to, but could, without self-consciousness, produce the most subjective work. And much of his poetry, if those of you who know Yeats, much of his poetry was about his best friends, about women he loved, about the Senate, about his family, the love of his life, Maud Gonne. Many of the poetry was love poetry, and he believed that that was appropriate for the phase of the moon that he was in. If you're born at earlier phases, you are probably going to have a very public life because you're developing the kinds of skills that are needed to survive in life. And if you are born somewhere around the 12th phase, we get our great heroes. And he talked about the lives of some of the great military leaders and what kind of sacrifice the mask requires when you are totally identified with the mask. So it's an interesting piece of work for those of you who have the patience to go through it and look at it. Mm-hmm. What does God win? He wins you back to Him, our consciousness. Well, everything that you've learned in this lifetime is retained in the spirit body, and you add that back into the total knowledge, the mind of the universe. It's about a mind that is continually growing. That is what God is in Yeats's system. So if you... He loses you when you incarnate. You are away from Him. And for the time that you're separated from God, He is diminished by that part. And so this is what the angel was saying to Yeats, which is, look, you're not doing your work. You're supposed to be here to write poetry, and you're not doing it. And if you don't do it, God is being cheated of this aspect of Himself. Not to a Platonist. It makes you a part of God, a spark. This part, maybe, or... You'll settle for that. I like that part myself, so God's little finger. Yeah. Now, these would be what he would call sophistic tricks to inflate yourself into that God position. And I think Plato had many arguments with his friends about this very issue. The phases of the moon are described in a beautiful poem that he wrote at the beginning of a vision. 28 phases of the moon, the full and the moon's dark and all the crescents. 28, and yet but 26 the cradles that a man must needs be rocked in, for there is no life at the full or the dark. From the first crescent to the half, the dream but summons to adventure, and the man is always happy like a bird or beast. But while the moon is rounding towards the full, he follows whatever whims most difficult. Although whims not impossible, and though scarred as with the cat of nine tails of the mind, his body molded from within, he grows more beautiful. 11 pass, and then Athena takes Achilles by the hair. Hector is in the dust, and Nietzsche is born, because the hero's crescent is the 12th. And yet, twice born, twice buried, grow he must, before the full moon, helpless as a worm. The 13th moon but sets the soul at war in its own being, and when the war's begun, there's no muscle in the arm. And after, under the frenzy of the 14th moon, the soul begins to tremble into stillness, to die into the labyrinth of the self. All thought becomes an image, and the soul becomes a body, that body and that soul too perfect to lie at the full in a cradle. And he believed that the first phase and the 15th phase were disincarnate. It's when you are in the first phase, you are recovering from your last 28 phases, so to speak. You are dreaming back and assimilating all of the knowledge and consciousness, ready to start again. And at the 15th phase, if you brought all of that light into a human body, it would simply burn the vehicle out. It would be too beautiful to behold. And so at the 14th phase, you find very beautiful people, beautiful women in particular, he thought. But at the 15th phase, the light is the full moon, and it's too bright. And he talks a lot about the effects of the full moon. You know, we can't sleep in it. You shouldn't go out in it. It affects us. It makes us howl. I mean, there were many images of that. After that, the crumbling of the moon, and the soul remembers its loneliness, shudders in many cradles. All is changed. It would be the world's servant, and as it serves, choosing whatever tasks most difficult among tasks not impossible, it takes upon the body and upon the soul the coarseness of a drudge. You can hear us all aging as this goes on. And finally, when all the dough has been so kneaded up, that it can take what form Cook nature fancies, the first thin crescent is wheeled round once more. So you're complete when you are pounded back into the part that's about to go in the oven again. If we look at the relationship of the sun and the moon, you could say this is the relationship of the male and the female. This is the dance of the opposites. And in a poem he wrote in late life called Under the Round Tower, he describes this. Of golden king and silver lady, bellowing up and bellowing round, till toes mastered a sweet measure, mouth mastered a sweet sound, prancing round and prancing up until they pranced upon the top. That golden king and that wild lady sang till the stars began to fade, hands gripped in hands, toes close together, hair spread on the wind they made. That lady and that golden king could like a brace of blackbirds sing. If you accept this cycle, you get this kind of a dance and harmony. And what a reincarnation theory like Plato or Yeats would describe is constant change. If you get too set in your ways or identify with particularly the mask, what Yeats would say is the top will topple, the body of fate will turn one more time, and you will be spun off and have to catch your balance. But you won't catch the same balance. It is impossible to recover if you have been touched by the body of fate. And if you accept the harmony, then you get this kind of a relationship. Jung would say animus and anima. This is called Solomon to Sheba. Sang Solomon to Sheba and kissed her dusky face. All day long from midday we have talked in the one place. All day long from shadowless noon we have gone round and round in the narrow theme of love like an old horse in a pound. To Solomon sang Sheba, planted on his knee, if you had broached a matter that might the learned please, you had, before the sun had thrown our shadows on the ground, discovered that my thoughts, not it, are but a narrow pond. Said Solomon to Sheba and kissed her Arab eyes, there's not a man or woman born under the skies dare match in learning with us two. And all day long we have found there's not a thing but love can make the world a narrow pond. If you accept this kind of an incarnation theory, you get the feeling that the Taoists talk about, which is all of life will meet you at the door. You don't have to even leave the room. And this is partly the way Yeats received a lot of his information, is that he sat and received and thought and read and danced with his anima, his silver lady. And he believed very much in what he was doing. And so you could say, yes, this is a belief system. But you could also say it's a dynamic system that worked for him and which he was in awe of, because he truly believed that if the tower called and the spiral staircase turned for you, you were touched and you walked in that sacred space. Campbell talks about the sacred space in The Quest of the Hero. Jung talks about the space that we walk in when something important is upon us, important dreams come to us. Yeats very much believed and lived in that space. His is a life about living in the body of fate. Others write about it. He tried to live in it. Margaret, would you like to finish again? Now listen to the poem again, and you begin to see what the young Yeats was already able to talk about.
I went out to the hazelwood because a fire was in my head, and cut and peeled a hazel wand and hooked a berry to a thread. And when white moths were on the wing and moth-like stars were fluttering out, I dropped the berry in a stream and caught a little silver trout. When I had laid it on the floor, I went to blow the fire aflame, but something rustled on the floor, and someone called me by my name. It had become a glimmering girl with apple blossom in her hair, who called me by my name and ran and faded through the brightening air. Though I am old from wandering through hollow lands and hilly lands, I will find out where she has gone, and kiss her lips and take her hands and walk among long dappled grass and pluck till time and times are done the silver apples of the moon, the golden apples of the sun.
Where did it fit in his ideas? Fred wanted to know what the crisis of the midlife, the turning, the metanoia, all of that turning back that we talk about in Jungian work, where does that fit in Yeats? And another part of the question was the Christ figure, and was Yeats a Christian? Where did he fit? And what kind of, where did this symbol fit? Yeats is of the son of a pre-Raphaelite atheist. He was a painter. He was someone who had thrown over all Christian doctrine and really was atheistic. Yeats was one of these people that was born thinking about God, and he and his father fought about this most of his life. His father, very much like W.H. Auden, could not understand why Yeats wasted his time worrying about things you could not prove, God being one of them. He was very much Irish, and he was very steeped in Celtic mythologies and the stories of the Fae, the She, the tall, shining people. He believed very much in the disincarnate. He had Protestant ministers in his uncle and I think a great uncle of his mother, that side of the family, but they were not, he was not brought up in a church. He made his own church. He was very connected to things natural and to beauty. He discovered Plato around the age of 17, and he discovered Blake about the same time, and Blake became his, you could say, disincarnate mentor, and he was very much caught up with Platonic and Blakean thought. When he was about 27, he discovered Swedenborg, who also Swedenborg would be what we'd call charismatic. And what Yeats rejected about Swedenborg is the church aspect. Yeats did not believe that you should form churches, per se. The turning back aspect that is most interesting in the fourth quarter of a man's life, the turning back has to do with a Platonic notion of returning your light to the larger light. And Yeats believed that there were two phases to this, one being in the body, where in later life you reflect on everything you have done and you begin to perfect your objective side, and you begin to disidentify with mask or role, and you begin to try to find what Plato would call essential form. And this would have to do with the largest possible concept you could imagine as the true meaning of man. Man is spirit in a body. And that's what he was striving to understand. The second phase of the turning back was at the moment of death and for some time while you shed the husk of this life. We were talking about what is ego and what is self in the Yeatsian system, and what a Platonist or a Yeatsian sheds after death is the personality, the incarnating personality, ego, of this lifetime. What you do is dream back through this life, and you shuck away everything except the lessons that you've learned. And you begin He believed that the soul is in a kind of dreaming state, and the turning back has to do with life review, but only so that you come up with essence, the essence of this lifetime was. When you've accomplished that, you go back into the larger life and you wait until the desire of the greater celestial body, you come up with your next agenda, you could say, or goal, and then you reincarnate again to accomplish that. So, but you have to remember that for Yeats, the essence of the universe is mind, and so these are forms in a way, but not in the same way that it's not like a pattern that gets made in the world. It's really a thought that is perfected. And God is a mind. And we are all thoughts in that mind. That is the way he would see it. So the turning back is really about shucking any semblance of personality or anything that would be important to incarnate life. Yes. They are part of the body of fate. Everything on the planet is part of a large idea, and everything on the planet is interacting to, you could say, evolve. And if you interact with other life, whether it is a rock or a tree or an animal, then it is the interaction that's important. And you pay attention. Again, you get that sense of attention or being mindful. It's a different world. It's not a world that, how would I say it? The world itself, in its third dimensional form, is an imperfect manifestation of the perfect thought in God's mind. And it, too, is evolving. And so change is important. War is important. Catastrophes are important because they're all an effort to balance that which is not yet perfect. So it's all evolving all at once. I used to think that, I would say yes, and I would qualify that by saying that Jung himself talked about it this way. When he was young and he first talked about the theory of individuation, he really did believe that all people had the potential, born at the moment of birth, of the entire self, and that we could individuate that. We could discover that and individuate that. What he meant by that was potential. Find your potential and develop it. What he then began to understand, and I think really around the age of 57, he changed the words he used. Around the age of 57, he did not talk any longer about the self and the ego. He talked about the soul. And he began to try to come up with a dynamic system that would articulate a development that he saw for very few people. And what he ended up at later life saying is that individuation is for the very few. The problem that he saw was, I think, not so different from what Yeats was seeing, is that it is the escape from the archetype and from the collective unconscious. if you are still caught in what he called maturation, Jung would say, that is just a life lived. When you consciously take on a development, then you are in an individuation process. So I would say Jung knows about the psychology of choice and that it has to be taken on in this very conscious way. Yeats is interesting because on the one hand, he comes from a system that says the essence of man is mind. And on the other hand, he believes that given enough lifetimes, we all will develop that potential. So he is a reincarnationist, and I think what Jung is trying to describe is the rapid development when one undertakes consciousness as a choice. So one's a psychology, one is a, a theosophy of sorts. I realize that, and I also urge you to look at what he put in the collective works. And I think there is Jung the psychologist, and there's Jung the autobiographer. There's Jung the interviewer when he's talking very candidly about belief systems and what he believes in and what he knows about God. And there's Jung who is very careful in his published works to talk about psychology. You see that in... And you have to say that this is a man who knew his audience. Yeats is a poet, and he just doesn't care about that. He didn't have to hedge. Jung is very much aware of his audience, and so you get the autobiography and you get the volumes that are very carefully labeled, and the sources are there. Yeats has no sources. Yeats was one of those people who read a lot, and then people talked about Yeats as being, he changed things. He borrowed ideas and then he changed them. He incorporated everything and he went on using it as his own. And Jung is very careful to talk about all of his sources. So I think it's two different personalities that work here. Yes. The wildness is in the first phases, phases 1 through 15. You get all that Sturm und Drang and wildness and will. And it is about moving away from the sun. And in the later phases is the coming together. It's turning back and seeing the lover and realizing that you're missing your other half, which is very Platonic, and racing toward that other half, and that is the light. So the dance at the most separate phases are the balance of the two. If you can imagine the sun being at phase 1 and the moon being at phase 15, they see each other and each finds the other beautiful, and for that opposition, it's a balanced dance, and you get that whirling and swirling effect. The sadness comes from the separation. Yes. The Great Beast, this is a wonderful poem called The Great, it's about the Second Coming. I will tell you three things about Yeats's visions besides what that poem means. Yeats was a man who you could say was a modern Nostradamus. And what Yeats's sadness was also about was what he called the coming age. But before the new age could dawn, there was to be a great time of turmoil and cleansing. And there were several phases of it. The first phase had to do with what we would call war, the riding of the horsemen, which he saw as unicorns trampling and destruction all around. The second phase was actually, you could say, a return of the Christ, but it was not going to be in the form of one incarnate being, because what he saw was many Christ figures returning all over the world. But the most terrible thing of all was the Antichrist. And that poem is about the coming of the Antichrist. And he was quite old when he had that vision. It was a dream. And that was the poem, rough beast that is slouching toward Bethlehem to be born. A dream he had was that there was to be born an Antichrist who would be so beautiful that we would all think that Christ had come again. And in fact, it would be, in his terms, what Nostradamus called the third man. We've already, in modern interpretation of Nostradamus, seen Napoleon and Hitler, and we're waiting for the third man. And it was this third man that Yeats had dreamt about, that he calls the beast. But he is an apocalyptic visionary, if you want to put it in those terms. Yeah. I have no idea. Being a Platonist, you see, in Plato's terms, he has all those kinds of love. And
I would assume that being a Platonist, he would...
Being a Platonist, you see, in Plato's terms, he has all those kinds of love. And I would assume that being a Platonist, he would simply describe it as one of the many forms of human love. And he would look at the fact that a woman could carry the king and a man could carry the queen, or a woman could carry the king and another woman could carry the queen. I don't think that gender has anything to do with how Yeats would see people in love. His poetry is about love, and I think what he'd be looking at is the soul essence. Very much a Platonic writer. Poetry is about this life, and in this life, for us to feel that desire, you need an object and a subject. And so what this life is about, the love objects that fly toward and away from one another, the king and the queen, could be archetypes, because we are in a body and that's how we understand it. But on a soul level, you are simply returning to the light. So what he would say is, I can't talk about the soul. I can only point to it. And this is a symbol that helps me understand what this greater essence is about. And it's about light and reflected light and unifying light and dispersion of light. And I see it as a king and a queen. That, and I think he would say, that's not my archetype so much as those are the symbols of the soul that can help you see the dance that we are in. And I think that's how he would talk about it.
How
Yeats, how did he face old age? Not very gracefully. He had his own fears of aging. He actually had one of those strange monkey gland operations when he was 68 or so to try to regain some libido. He had a young wife. He was raising children. He had been an Irish senator. And I think the proper answer is that he was a good Platonist. He gathered all of his tools up until age 52, 53. He then devoted himself to service, as his poetry would say. At the third phase, you serve, and you serve, and you serve. And then at the age of 63, he retired from public life, and he wrote his greatest poetry. And so what you have to do is see the man in the light of modern critics say this is the most artificial person that's ever lived on the planet. He is totally into some kind of self-made world. Yeats would say that's the point. I made myself conscious, and I chose, and I lived out my options, and I listened to the body of fate when it hit me, and I took it on. So he took on public kinds of lives. He then shucked them off and was grateful that his service as a senator had earned him the right to be a recluse until death. And so at the age of 63, he left public life and began writing some really incredible visionary poetry, which a lot of critics say is so obscure, who wants to read it? But I think you have to look at the poetry in light of a man who studied in things that interested him, incorporated them into his life, and as a result of it had a wisdom, which certainly comes out of a system. You cannot read his poetry unless you know a little bit about Plato and Blake. But he would say that's the point. Poetry is very hard work. Yeah. Yes, everything I've ever learned I've given to you in this beautiful poem. If you can't understand it, well then, start with these books, and he would give you the reading list. 74. He died in Italy. He was all of his life plagued with respiratory problems. He died in 1939. They could not get his body out of... he was buried in Italy. And at some point, the Irish government, after the war, returned his remains to Ireland. He died working. The day he died, he was working on The Black Tower and under Ben Bulbin. I mean, these were poems that were in progress, almost completed. The Black Tower had very little work to be done. His wife finished it, actually, the last few stanzas from notes that he had left. He also loved her, and it was simply one of those unresolved, unrequited relationships that drove him nuts. But he really believed that on a spirit level they were meant for each other. And they were joined in the work of the Irish Rebellion for many, many years. Maud Gonne he met when they were both 21 years old, and they were the vanguard of the Irish Rebellion. She was a dynamic speaker who could get armies to follow her. And he wrote a poem about her called No Second Troy. And of course they had to fight a war in Ireland, and of course they had to burn things. There was no other Troy to burn. She was that beautiful. And she... they remained friends their entire life. She ended up in prison, and he took her in. He and his wife gave her refuge. But it was unrequited in the sense that she had only her eye on war, not on Yeats. She divorced him. And why did she divorce him? Because he was hiding out in France. He was a coward. Yes, but you know, you have to come back to Ireland. The troops are waiting. And she did have an interesting son who really carried on the work, and particularly in the Irish Senate. So, Sean. Well, I hope that you are interested in this poet at this point and can get some joy from his work, because it's meant to be great, beautiful, passionate work, and it's really meant for reciting at the top of your lungs. He liked it's full of rhythm, it's full of beautiful, rounded verse. And do read it out loud. You will get much more out of it if you read it out loud. And read it to each other. Yep.
Thank you. And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.